everyone, and welcome back. Happy New Year. This is Vito again for Fox Chatter episode 4 leading into January. I hope everyone had a great, relaxing, reflective time over Christmas and the New Year. Well, to prioritize correctly, I know, coming back for January drill the week after the New Year is tough. It's always been tough for me because you have to go from 0 to 60. So let's try to take it at a moderate pace this week as we jump in. As we look at January drill, our focus is getting ready for our big exercise in March. So it's to do our normal stuff and get ready for March. I'm going to talk a little bit about that in a minute, but what I do want to do is give a couple of updates of some items from December that you may or may not be aware of. Not a whole lot of gigantic things happening in December, which is great, but we did have a real world ACA tasking that lasted multiple days. So if you were unaware of that, which you very well may have been, know that our guys and gals down there launched multiple times to perform a mission that I can't talk about on the podcast, but that you will undoubtedly find both very interesting, probably slightly more than slightly concerning, and very applicable to what we are preparing to do. So we'll have some intel briefs over January that'll cover that. I would encourage you to get to one of those. If you can't get one of those, I would encourage you to find your way to a vault and ask a few questions about it, because there are things happening in the homeland that are concerning and that our real world mission here deals with. So that was one of the larger things that we encountered in December and handled like champs. So thanks to our ACA warriors for that. As far as an update from our 130 plus airmen over in the Central Command AOR, I thankfully don't have much to report there, which feels good. I think things have settled down with them. I've been in contact with the leadership over there, and I'm going to go visit later this month. Myself, Colonel Hummel, and Chief Hartzog are going to go over there and visit, but everything sounds like it's going well for them over there. So that's a sigh of relief. Before I get into a little bit more about what the next year is going to look like, I want to pause for a second and not do this at the end. I want to give some shout outs to people who did a great job over the month of December. Winterfest was awesome. Lieutenant Gallman, Chief Master Sergeant Green did what I would term as the best one that I've seen, which is always what we want, right? It doesn't take away from anyone who did it in previous years. It's just to say we stand on the shoulders of the people before us, and we couldn't do as nearly as good without the foundation they set in place, but they used that foundation that had been built and they took it to another level. So it was a great job and much, much appreciated. I also want to give a shout out to Master Sergeant Laura Quattlebaum. She's working at 15th Air Force on the Raider team over there. And the Raider team was nominated to ACC for the United States Air Force Outstanding Science and Engineering Award. And what they are doing is designing a platform over there that helps prepare airmen for deployment and tracks it, builds it, and they're looking to unleash that on the entire Air Force. So great job, Master Sergeant Quattlebaum. Thanks for doing that. And that's just another example of our people who are working in other areas really getting highlighted for doing a great job. I also want to talk about some people that, unfortunately, much like the ACA thing, I can't give you enough details on, but I really wish I could. Major Augustine, Master Sergeant Mayberry, and now Captain Ray White have all been working over in UCOM for the Gray Wolf team. I can't give any details on what the Gray Wolf team does, but if you've been following the news at all, you know what the most significant event is happening in UCOM, and they are working on that. And I will tell you that they are making significant real-world contributions. And so if you have an opportunity once again in the vault to learn a little bit more about that, what I just want you to know is that your friends, our airmen at McIntyre, are all over doing things that are applicable, not just on the deployments you know about, but are things behind the scene. We are requested, we have a reputation, and we're sending people to accomplish those. So great job to everyone. that leads me into, well, what are we doing to prepare for our real world mission? And as I talk about every month, and we'll continue to talk about, Typhoon Fox is our thing. We have made great progress over the last few months, and you're about to see the rubber hit the road. So we have a template for the March exercise. We said we were going to do crawl, walk, run. There will be some crawling, some walking, and we might break into a little bit of a jog over the March drill. It's going to be a 4-day drill. Every airman will be associated with this exercise in some way, shape, or form. However, it won't be what you're used to. Not all 1,350 of us are going to be associated with the main effort, because that would be sprinting, and we're not ready to sprint yet. And so we're going to have a main effort that simulates a deployment from a MOB, main operating base, to a FOB, forward operating base. And that will be a select group of people, because as you've heard us talk about, we couldn't take everyone that we want to, because there's just not enough room to do it at these small operating locations. So we're going to take a small contingent. They're going to do a pseudo deployment. They're going to take off from McIntyre. They're going to land at McIntyre, but it's not McIntyre. It's somewhere else. And they're going to operate out of that environment. We're going to do a swap out so that we get another 80-ish people a touch of what that environment's going to be like. But that leaves a lot of us still back here at McIntyre. And so we're going to do a lot of part task training for what this PACOM deployment could look like. So every squadron, every group has a series of tasks that they will accomplish, a series of training events that your commanders are coming up with. There may be some of us that end up going out to North Oxfield as well. We're working that, but we're going to have a number of things that will build up so that as we grow this exercise, we'll get more people involved with the main effort. But this is what the crawl, walk, jog is going to look like. And I'm excited for what that plan is going to be. Which leads to the next logical question of, hey, Vito, well, that sounds great. That's what we're doing in March. Well, what does the rest of the year look like? You talk about building it out. So we have the March exercise. And then in May, we have Sentry Savannah. Sentry Savannah is going to be more of an execution-focused exercise. So a lot of aviation package, particularly pilots, executing at a high level in large force employment exercises with a lot of other units over the course of 2 weeks. So a real high-end environment. We are going to try to get everyone else some ACE training associated with that exercise, but we're not 100% sure the exercise is supportive of that. So we have other options that we're planning. Additionally, in May, the medical group is planning a med flag, which will be a massive joint force. So think multi-service medical evacuation exercise using our doctors, aeromedical evacuation, and they're going to get a lot of great training out of that. Fast forward a little bit as we continue to do our training on the side, day to day, week to week, month to month, and we are looking for another TDY mini deployment sometime in July, August timeframe. I've been trying not to hype this up too much because I have great expectations for this being a very exciting thing, but it's got a ways to go to really flesh out the details. But we are trying to do a trip to somewhere in the Southcom AOR, and Southcom AOR is anywhere south of the United States. And what we want to do is present a TDY that would be to a, let's just call it a PACOM representative environment that is also a really good deal. As of last week, there were a dozen reasons that it wouldn't happen. We've taken a few steps forward. We're down to just 10 reasons why it won't happen, but we're really trying to make it happen. I think it could be a really great training environment to go to a PACOM representative place, be able to practice a hub and spoke, maybe even from McIntyre, bringing supplies back and forth, and also be able to have a really good deal by going to somewhere that I think everyone will really enjoy. We're working diligently on that. We think it would be great training and a great time. And that would be July, August timeframe. And then that leads us into our midpoint exercise. So midpoint inspection, which is in October. And we're looking at a 3-day drill for that. And we're looking to do that as more of a generation exercise, because we will have done multiple employment exercises, ACE exercises. And so now what we want to do is a really robust, think Palmetto pressure on steroids type of exercise with very few simulations. So I think that's what excites most of us the most about it. Generation is not a super sexy thing, but being able to do it without any simulations, we think would be really cool. And that is kind of our build up for the year to get us to what I think is a sustainable entry point to consider ourselves moderately MCA ACE qualified by October of next year. And so that's the overall plan. That's why I keep talking about it. And I'm really proud of everyone. I think we're making great strides in that direction. I think people have really embraced it. And one of the things we keep hearing from conferences is warrior culture, warrior mentality. And so as we get into these exercises, that's what we'll be asking for people. And fit to fight, I'm laying the groundwork for that. You're going to hear more from me on that. If you have more questions, I'll meet you at the gym and we can talk about what fit to fight looks like, because that's what we're wanting to get everyone up to that as well. So to work that into, you know, what you're thinking for yourself and what a deployment would be like, is it's going to be challenging physically as well. So that's what we have on tap. That's what our plan is moving forward. And that's the big items that we have that I really want to talk about. I have a special guest with us today. Master Sergeant Chris Vine from the 245th is here. He recently deployed on was it 180 day to Al-Asad? Is that what your deployment was?
Yes, sir.
And Chris was awarded a Bronze Star for his service over there, which is incredibly impressive. So I wanted to bring him on and just talk to us a little bit about what he did. So Chris, can you just start by talking a little bit about what your tasking was and what you expected to do when you walked out the door?
Yes, sir. So I was sent over there as a contracting officer representative. So my job was to make sure that the contractors that we have over there are doing their job. So that's what I got sent over there for. When I showed up, I was actually the flight chief for the air operations flight, which entailed overseeing the communication guys and as well as our radar airfield weather systems that we had on the airfield.
So a complete change from what you thought you were going to be doing over there. You thought you were going to be handling administrative contracts. Now you're leading human beings in a combat theater.
Yes, sir.
Awesome.
Yes, sir.
How did you feel? Did you feel prepared for that?
Absolutely.
Awesome. So you went in there. Were you excited about the change?
I was. So like I said, I showed up and it was day one. Hey, this is what you're actually going to be doing. So I was excited. I knew I was going to be busy. I knew I was going to be challenged, and I was excited.
So Chris, tell me a little bit more about what happened on the most, I guess I would say, interesting and consequential night that you had over there on your deployment.
Yes, sir. So at this point in the deployment, we were getting pretty used to incoming or indirect fire. Most of the time it was of no concern to us. It would land far outside the wire and we didn't have to worry about it other than just having to go hang out in the bunker for a little while.
So how often would this happen?
Pretty often, I would say at least, you know, a couple times a week.
So you were getting hit pretty regularly by rockets. And my understanding of the type of rockets that the militia over there use now are significantly upgraded than over the rockets that most of us in the 169th experienced when we were in Iraq or Afghanistan in 2008, 2012. I think these seem to have the ability to do some very significant damage.
Yes, sir. Along with the one-way UASs, right? So that's also a concern.
Yes.
So there's things flying overhead all the time, and you never know if it's a bad guy or a good guy. And that's why we have to take it so serious, right?
Got it.
So again, that particular night, so we all go to the bunker, and these are loud noises. So to the average person, this is a major concern at that point. And they were getting closer. So you could tell that the very first one sounded off in the distance. And then as we worked up to that fifth one, it sounded like it was very close to our living quarters. So yeah, so this one sounded substantial, or this particular attack sounded very substantial.
Can you feel the impacts or just hear them?
Absolutely.
So that speaks to a significant caliber of munition.
Yes, sir. So again, we go into the bunker and... I can't remember how long we were in there, but I'm worried about accountability and I'm worried about my guys and where everybody is, because we're kind of scattered around. Some people are on shift at this time. Some people are off shift at the time. So trying to gather accountability. And then when we get that initial release, all essential personnel are allowed to go out and assess their areas and inspect for damage or make sure that, you know, the conditions are safe for everybody to go back. That's when I went over to our headquarters building and was able to identify the more specifics of what just occurred. And, you know, that there were a couple that actually hit the runway surface.
What did they do to the runway?
They took massive chunks out of the concrete.
What size?
So I would say like a basketball, right? A solid basketball. And then 4 or 5 inches deep. But then the actual blast radius outside of that from shrapnel and everything, I mean, you could find pieces of shrapnel, you know, 100 feet away. So substantial.
So the airfield is damaged.
Yes, sir.
No people were injured in this one.
No, sir.
Thank God. Airfield is damaged. Airfield is closed, correct?
Yes.
And it is now, is it directly your job to get the airfield open again?
Yes. So based off of our protocols, we'll call it, the contractors would typically go out there because they're the experts. Our airfield managers are the experts of identification of that runway, making sure that it's safe. But they can't go out there. It's still too, we'll say, quote unquote, hostile for our contractors to be able to go out. So that's when I decided that I should just go out and look so that we could expedite whatever needed to be done.
So the contractors, it's not in their scope of work to go out there and examine it.
Yes,
so you, Master Sergeant Vine, say, I got to get this airfield going again. I'm going to go back out there and assess the situation.
Yes, sir.
So you assess it and then what happened after that?
So identify the runway needs repair. So my first thing to do is contact CE and start those efforts of repairing that hole that's in the runway.
So this is not your job, but it's your responsibility.
Yes, sir.
You feel like it is your responsibility, but it is not your job. So you are taking that and basically running with it because you feel a sense of obligation to get things going again when the situation is still not quite right for the people who should be doing it to do it.
Absolutely.
Awesome. So that runway, you were able to get it repaired. How long is the runway closed for before they can get it operational again?
So what was it? 4 hours? Roughly it took to get that completely fixed.
And is Al-Asad normally a 24/7 type of operation with things going at all hours? And what is the primary mission that was being executed out of Al-Asad? Still counter ISIS?
It's counter ISIS. Yes. We're more of a hub for forward deploying at this point, further forward deploying, I guess I should say. So yes, we're a forward operating base to stage material in support of counter ISIS.
Okay, tell me a little bit more about. So that was the biggest night there. I know you also had another significant contribution to the mission while you were over there. Can you just tell us a little bit about that and how you went above and beyond there?
Yes, sir. So the radar there provides imagery to the 727th Expeditionary Air Control Squadron, and they are responsible for counter UAS and C2 for the entire AOR. So our radar at Al-Asad was particularly important because it covered that whole area of responsibility.
And it is responsible for tracking incoming UASs and potentially rockets,
correct?
Yes, sir.
It's a long-range radar.
Got it.
So for everything, so for aircraft separation and counter UAS is what they use that radar for.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a major outage. It's a strange situation. So it's not a U.S.-owned radar system. It's maintained by one of our coalition forces. And so when that image was no longer available to us, I took it on as my responsibility to figure out how to restore that. And then, you know, I think I told you, you know, it's overcoming that language barrier quite literally, you know, working with the Germans who own the radar at
sure.
the time.
How long was the radar down for?
Oh, weeks. So I'd say, I think it took about 3 weeks to get it fully operational again.
And was this another one of those items that was not your job, but you felt a responsibility to it and a background from your experience in the 245th that you can contribute to this?
Yeah, that wasn't our mission at all. But yeah, in that seat, you know, there was a lot of things being thrown our way. So
absolutely.
Yes.
So you're doing things that are outside your lane just to get the mission done and to keep the people on base safer and to keep the operation going. If I were to take all that and summarize it, I would say under fire, maintaining the mission, keeping the airfield operational and going outside of your lane, but using any expertise you have to keep the base, your fellow servicemen and women safe.
Absolutely. Yes, sir.
And so obviously your superiors there saw those actions as a superior contribution. And
yes,
for that, they decided to submit you for the Bronze Star, correct?
Yes, sir.
And so how would you quantify your actions? Do you feel heroic in what you accomplished?
I don't know if I would say I feel heroic. I did what was asked of me.
That's right.
Right. Yeah. So my leadership challenged me. And I was happy to accept that.
And you rose to the occasion.
Yes, sir.
So, you know, I think it's a great just discussion to have of a Bronze Star deployed is a significant accomplishment. And not everyone gets it. Do you, how many other people that you were assigned with received the Bronze Star?
As far as I know, nobody.
There are sometimes people who confuse Bronze Star with active heroism, and there is a Bronze Star with valor for that. Your Bronze Star is for taking care of the job under fire in a deployed environment and going above and beyond.
Yes, sir.
And I would like to think, and I hope a lot of people who are listening here to this today think, you know what? I hope I'm challenged in the same way, and I hope that I could rise to the occasion the same way that Master Sergeant Vine did. And so I'm really proud of you from the 169th Fighter Wing Commander seat, and I hope that this is a motivator for other people that you never know what you're going to get tasked with when you're deployed, and you need to be fit to fight, and you need to be prepared to go, and you don't know what you're going to get tasked with. And when you go, I hope that everyone has the same can-do attitude, warrior spirit, get the job done, contribute in any way possible to do it. So I really thank you, Chris, for what you did and what you continue to do. Excited to have you here as a member of our wing, and really proud that we could send you off and just have you perform the way you did. It's a significant accomplishment. There are very few members of this wing. I don't know if I can think of any off the top of my head that have a Bronze Star that are in the unit right now. So way to go in a deployed environment. Thank you.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Okay. For the next segment, I have a special guest here today, Wing Command Chief, Chief Master Sergeant Rob Hartzog. I asked Chief to come in and talk to all of you about the Wing Enlisted Development Plan. We've been working on that over the past couple of months and are excited to reveal it. So Chief, can you just tell me a little bit about your overall philosophy for the enlisted plan?
Sure. Thanks for inviting me today, Colonel Ferraria. I'm excited to get the plan out. We started this a few months ago. And basically what the plan is doing, it's a guide on what our enlisted force should be looking at or doing at their particular rank. Everyone will have the guide in their email January drill. So just take a look at it. And the way we've broken it down is each rank has its own set of guidelines. And I want to emphasize they are guidelines and not a checklist. A lot of people look at these things and they start trying to check boxes. And that's not what we're about. We're trying to get our young folks to learn to lead at an earlier age. And the only way we can do that is kind of a two-part effort. We're going to work through the enlisted councils to teach leadership principles earlier. And this guide plays a part in that. It kind of tells you where we want you to be at any certain point in your career. If you're behind, that's okay. You can catch up. But, you know, it is a guide and not a checklist. That's what I really want to emphasize today.
Excellent. Yeah, because it is a very detailed development program. And as you said, you're going to see a lot of steps in there, but not every one of those is a required step. They are all ways to get to the end. And what I really want to highlight is a phrase that you used in there that is really important to me, and that is leading at an earlier age. Would you agree that that's kind of our impetus behind why the wing is doing this?
Absolutely. Yeah. With the influx of AGR positions, we're shortening our careers at McIntyre. So what we want to do is you don't have 35 years to get into a supervisory role. You may be asked to be a supervisor at the 15-year point. So we really need to get folks trained on leadership principles and how to step up sooner rather than later in their careers.
Absolutely. And one of the things we've identified is we probably haven't given enough opportunities to our staffs and techs to lead, and we need to provide them with more opportunities. And you'll see that in the enlisted development guide is those opportunities need to be presented so that we can get our NCOs ready to go instead of being in the background. And so I think that's one of the biggest things you should take out of this is if you look at this guide as a way to get promoted, you're not wrong, but you're also not catching everything. What we really need, we want to promote you, but we need you to be a leader to get promoted, and we need to train you. And we're not looking at this as a you have failed up to this point by not achieving this. We're looking at this as, hey, the wing needs to develop its enlisted corps in a more methodical way. We need to set expectations at each level, and we are looking to quantify that so that we are a little bit more consistent across the wing.
Another thing that plays into it is the MCA concept, multi-capable airmen. You're going to have plenty of opportunities to lead at younger ages and ranks, and that's what we have to do. If we don't do it, the MCA concept's not going to work.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because with the MCA concept, what we see is there just aren't as many airmen to do all the jobs. So leadership is an absolute requirement, and lack of specific guidance will also likely be something that is experienced in some of those deployed environments, and certainly in our exercises. And so we need our airmen, our NCOs, ready to run and excited about taking the reins. Chief, any other thoughts on the enlisted development plan, things that you want people to have as a takeaway before they dig into it?
One thing about the plan, we've said it a couple of times, it's not a checklist, but they are opportunities to lead in there, and a lot of volunteerism stepping up. If it's not a promotion guide, is what you said, and that's absolutely true. If you step up and lead and do the right things, promotions come without asking. That happens. So I hope everybody looks at it in a positive light, and we want to get everybody ready for the national level, where we have a lot of leadership courses that we aren't really getting right now because we don't have some of these things done with our senior enlisted. So that's another part, is we need our senior enlisted to start looking at it and getting their squares filled so that we can get them leadership courses on the national level.
Absolutely. And those are opportunities that we feel like we don't want to force people into. But what we have had in recent years is people who wanted to go to them that were unable to. And so we want to help set the table so that the people who want to do those courses understand what the requirements are to get into them years before they reach that point, so that they can set themselves up for success. The other thing I really captured from what you're saying is this is not going to be just for me to go to the next level, I need to do this. This is also supervisors need to understand this so that they know how to give that responsibility as well. It's as much for the supervisor to understand this development guide as it is for the actual individual. And so it's from all levels to understand. And that's something I would say many of us struggle with. We, especially when you're at McIntyre and you're used to doing a lot of things on your own day to day, it can be difficult to delegate to your DSGs.
Yes, sir.
Please do that, though. And we are willing to accept the costs of learning, because those costs are worth bearing in training. So we need everyone to accept that delegation, accept that. This is tough for some people. I'm talking to myself right now, that doing it yourself can feel easier, but it's not the right thing for the organization. Share that responsibility and allow your people to grow. Any parting words, Chief?
One more thing we touched on. Leadership training at the council meetings. We will be doing that. We're going to be teaching the 21 irrefutable laws of leadership. We haven't devised the whole schedule yet, but we're working on that now. And we're also going to do intel briefs. So if you could, supervisors, this is a shot for you. Make sure that you allow your folks to get to these, because it's only going to help you.
Yes, please. And we are working as a wing to help find places in the schedule that will be more accessible for everyone to get to. It's very difficult to do, but we're working towards that, and that is a priority. Thanks for your time today, Chief.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
The last thing I want to get to is talking about some of our mailbag issues that we're looking to close out. The first one, I'll just get to the really ugly one first. Me, the wing commander, I am not successful at getting your back gate open, and I'm sorry. It's still not going, and I wish I could fix it, and I can't, and I don't know how to do it yet, but I'm trying to do better. But the back gate is still closed. They're still having issues with the control board. They've had some drainage issues and flooding that have damaged it, and we can't get it reliably open yet. The current time frame is middle of this month, and I'm doing the best I can to maintain the pressure. And it's important to me, and I want you to know it's important to me, but I have not been successful yet. So that was the ugly one. Now let's talk about a good one. There was a lot of comments, or there were comments that I completely agreed with and discussed about the hotels, and your FSS squadron has done an outstanding job at coming up with alternatives. And those alternatives start this drill. So the Comfort Inn is kaput. We're done with them. It's over. And our team has found some affordable hotels that they think are a significant upgrade. And they actually think you guys are going to like them a lot, that are in Sumter. We wish they were in Columbia because we understand that's more centrally located. But the reason we were at La Quinta and Comfort Inn in the first place was because we didn't have enough money for the nicer hotels in Columbia. So we have to balance everything. And so what we have that balance is nicer hotels that we think you'll like, but a little bit further of a drive. We are going to try to prioritize the people that come from that side, obviously, but we've secured some additional lodging in Sumter. That's going to be a real upgrade. So the Comfort Inn is done. The La Quinta is on the chopping block. It might be done by the time you hear this, but I don't want to overpromise. We're working through that process of finding enough additional space so that we can free ourselves from them as well. So I just want to thank the FSS for, they did a lot of work. They had a team, they visited a lot of hotels, and they were able to make excellent assessments and move forward with your request and my tasking fairly quickly. The last comment I'd like to share is from Senior Master Sergeant Kevin Crosby. And I could try to like summarize it myself, but I think his words are more powerful. And it is not necessarily a call for action, but it's a call for protocol. So I'm going to read it direct because I want to give Kevin the credit for doing this. And Kevin, thanks for writing this whole thing out. Here it is. Good morning, sir. Something I'd love to be shared on the podcast if you have time to spare. A short grammar and history lesson regarding our unit that has been lost. We are the Swamp Fox. It is singular, not plural. I encourage everyone to take a look at the history of our unit. We are not the Swamp Foxes, as is commonly misstated. It's our patch, and I believe underemphasized. Other fighter wings and squadrons' mottos or mascots are plural, but not us. Together, we are one. The one and only Swamp Fox. No individual can be the Swamp Fox without his brothers and sisters with them. More importantly, we cannot be the Swamp Fox without each and every one of our members. It is together and only together that we truly remain the Swamp Fox. It is through that unity that we remain highly effective in our future endeavors. This is a lesson I was taught early on in my career and one I constantly cherish. But with the fast-paced nature of what we do, it seems to have been lost. Perhaps more so due to a grammatical mistake than arbitrarily forgetting our roots. It is, nevertheless, an important grammar rule when we address ourselves to ensure unity in everything we do. This may seem insignificant to some, but I truly believe that our identity is crucial to our success. Well said, Kevin. Well said. I've learned the same lesson when I came in, and I've strived over the years to call us the Swamp Fox, and I agree with you. I don't think it is intentional, and I think the history lesson and the way that you pose that is powerful. And so I have nothing else to add other than that, than to say, bravo, I agree. That is who we are. And I think that's a great way to end the podcast. I hope everyone has a great drill. See you at McIntyre.